From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we remember soul singer Teddy Pendergrass, who died Wednesday at the age of 59 of complications from colon cancer. Pendergrass was the lead singer for Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes before going solo and singing to crowds of adoring women.
Close the door. Let me give you what you've been waiting for. Baby, I got so much love to give. And I want to give it all to you.
Also, the Iraq war film The Hurt Locker is now out on DVD. We talk with director Catherine Bigelow and screenwriter Mark Boll. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Fish Tank.
Let's bring this day to a pleasant end.
First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today on Fresh Air, we'd like to take some time to remember Philadelphia soul singer Teddy Pendergrass, who died Wednesday at age 59 of complications from colon cancer. Among his many hits was this one, Love TKO.
Looking back over my years, I guess I shed some tears. I told myself time and time again, this time I'm gonna win. But another fight, things ain't right, I'm losing again. Takes a fool to lose twice, start all over again. Think I better let it go. Looks like another love TKO. What you think about it, girl? Oh, yeah. Try to take control of the love, love to control me.
Teddy Pendergrass singing Love TKO. Pendergrass was one of the singers most identified with the Philly sound of the 1970s. He was the lead singer for Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, who had such hits as If You Don't Know Me By Now and The Love I Lost. When Pendergrass went solo, he became the first black male singer to record 5 consecutive multi-platinum albums. In 1982, he was in a car accident that left him a quadriplegic, but he slowly returned to singing and performing. Terry spoke with Teddy Pendergrass in 1998 after the publication of his autobiography, Truly Blessed. Teddy Pendergrass started singing in church as a child. When he was young, he says, he felt a calling to preach sermons. Terry asked him if he thought he'd grow up to be a preacher.
That is what I'm sure my mother thought I would do. And at the time, until I learned different, until I grew up, that's probably what I thought I would do as well. It's just that when you reach that ripe old age of 13, young kids, you know, they start to grow up and grow out, and they get, you know, get into their own thing and start doing their own thing. And I started getting involved in music and becoming interested in what we call secular music. And I saw, got a chance to see Jackie Wilson.
You said that's the experience that really changed you.
It changed my life around. So it was.
What was it about the Jackie Wilson performance?
Just a consummate performer to me. Just my image of him was just so huge. And he just controlled that stage. His audience was in the palm of his hands. And as I say in the book, you know, the ladies ran down to the front of the stage when they thought he had fell off to hurt himself. He had just rolled off intentionally and rolled off onto the floor. And to see the ladies run through the guardrails and just lay on top of him and appear to make mad, passionate love to him in the middle of the floor at whatever time it was that morning, to me it was just, my jaws dropped. It was like, my God.
How can I do that?
Right. Yeah. That's what I wanted to do.
Your mother worked in a club. She worked mm-hmm. in the kitchen of a club. Mm-hmm. And the club, well, I think Chubby Checker played there. Mm-hmm. I forget who else. But
lots of artists. Frankie Avalon, a whole lot of people.
Did that give you a sense, because I know you went with her sometimes, that performers could be accessible as well as being like Jackie Wilson, as well as being as grand as that? There were performers who were kind of in reach.
Well, no, that this, to me, it was just a huge thing. I mean, I was a child, 14 years old, meeting Chubby Checker. It was like, this was an opportunity of a lifetime.
Right.
It was huge to
right.
me. It just so happened to be, as I told my kid, the kid friends I had, my mom works at a club where this one goes, that one goes. We were off limits to that. We were black working in the kitchen. So, you know what I mean? It wasn't accessible. To us.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
It
yeah.
was still out of, it was just a different, medium. One was a club where people sat and ate dinner, and those people that went in there were white. For me, at the Uptown Theater, it was black kids. So that's where I went, because that's where people were that I could relate to. I felt very out of place at Skeelers. I felt loved. And I felt that I didn't feel like because of the color of my skin was a problem. because the family there treated all of us, my mother and me, like, just like we were like their kids or their like their grandkids, like they treated their grandkids. But we weren't allowed, wasn't allowed to sit out into the out in the hall and sit out there and hang out with everybody else. Number one, because I was underage. Number two, because I never saw any black people out there. So my mother always kept me in the kitchen with her.
You first performed professionally with a small group that you met in Atlantic City. And then you moved on from that group to perform with the Cadillacs. And the Cadillacs' big hit had been Speedo, but I think this was a period when the Cadillacs had kind of franchised, so there were several there were several groups singing under the name the Cadillacs.
Right.
That's happening more and more with oldies acts now. I'm wondering if anybody ever got really angry with you when they realized that this wasn't necessarily the original
They didn't get mad at me because I was a drummer. I was just a guy in the band.
All right.
I could care less.
Did they get angry, though, at the singers?
I don't know. I could care less.
Really?
It was a job. Thank goodness I had ability to play as well as sing. So therefore, I could get a job playing until I could find a job singing.
So drums was secondary to you. What you really wanted to do is sing.
Mm-hmm.
Harold Melvin needed more backup singers, so he hired the group you were with, the Cadillacs, to be his new Blue Notes.
Mm-hmm.
So there you were, part of Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes.
As the drummer.
Mm-hmm. How did you start singing, even though you were hired as the drummer? Because you became the lead singer.
Yeah, that was an interesting transition. How do I explain? As the drummer, I was the only musician that Harold hired from the band, which was the band for the Cadillacs. So he took the singers, and he liked the way I played so much, he offered me a job. At the time, I said, oh, okay, more money, just another job. You know, he didn't fire me. Great, fine. We began to realize that sometimes the group would be late. If they were late, the club owners would dock them. We would all make less money. So the band began to sing the songs that the group would sing if they were late in order to make sure ensure that we got paid. So sometimes the Blue Notes would come in and hear us singing, and I'd be sitting on the drums playing and singing. So then they realized, oh, this guy can sing. And from there, just evolved.
Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes was signed by Gamble and Huff, mm-hmm. Philadelphia International Records. What do you think was unique about their approach to production? And maybe another way I should put it first is, what changed about the sound of the group once you were part of Philadelphia International?
Well, I think when they came to see us at the Apollo Club in Camden, New Jersey, in 1970, what they heard was a group with a lot of dimension. They saw a group with a lot of class, a lot of savvy, a lot of experience. If nothing else, Harold was a taskmaster, and he was extremely knowledgeable about show business and how we should perform, what we should look like as a unit, how you should do things together. The choreography was like one person was dancing. I mean, we truly could work the gamut because we had to. We had to work in front of little white ladies with blue hair in Miami Beach, and we had to work in front of pimps and hustlers and prostitutes in New York or Buffalo or wherever we were. So we had to really know what we were doing in order to continue to work, because we were working because of our reputation. We had no records.
I want to play one of your really big hits during the Philadelphia International era with Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. This is The Love I Lost. You say in your memoir that originally this was supposed to be a ballad, but then the tempo got picked up. What were the changes that this song went through during the production, and why did it go through them?
It's just once you're in the studio, magic happens, because you're in there with live musicians, and as you try different feels, you try things, and that's the ability that you have with live musicians that you don't have with computers.
This is The Love I Lost, Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, my guest Teddy Pendergrass singing me.
The love I lost. Hoping that you and I could make it all through, but something went wrong. We loved each other, we just couldn't get along. Take a good look at me, I'm in misery. Can't you see? But love
was a sweet love.
Yes, it was.
Love I Lost, one of the big hits of the 70s with my guest Teddy Pendergrass singing lead.
Oh, that was good. I haven't heard this song in a long time.
Did your fans realize that the lead voice they were hearing was the voice of Teddy Pendergrass and not Harold Melvin? Because the group is called Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, and you would assume that right. He was the lead singer.
Right. Well, my friends knew, but nobody else knew. And that was what really got me after a while. So, a lot of times...
Do people not believe you sometimes? You say, but that's me singing lead, did they say?
Not my I didn't really tell anybody.
Oh.
I'm not one like that. But however, in clubs and places we would work, and they would come to me and go, oh, that was a great show, Harold. And I'd say, I'm not Harold, that's Harold. And people would just kind of look like, huh? You know, I guess they thought I was on dope or dog food or something because I wasn't acknowledging that I was who they just knew I was. And that was quite different. And it got to a point on our third album that I demanded that my name be put on the record. I was tired of being called Harold and I wanted my just dues.
After you went on your own, you eventually started doing, in addition to your regular concerts, you started doing for women only shows. What was the difference between what you did on stage or what you sang in the For Women Only shows than the rest of your concerts?
The difference was they were probably a little more provocative. I probably played to the audience a lot more because they were all female. And subtle differences like that.
What impact did it have on your ego and your personal life to be a romantic icon?
Did it have and does it have? Or did it because it's not over.
So my impression, though, is that your ego is in a different place now than it was before. My impression just from things that you've said is that you felt that your ego at times was a little out of control earlier and that's no longer the case.
It was all new. All new. And when you get that kind of adulation and people are just at your beck and call and at your feet, giving you what you want. I was a young kid, 26 years old, 27 years old. 20, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It can alter your thinking from it. Sometimes your head is too big to get through a door. And mine got there. I was able to, you know, bring things back into perspective. But, yeah, it can alter your ego. It can give you a nice big one. I mean, at 28 years old, I mean, I was buying a 34-room mansion in Gladwin. It's kind of, you know, coming from a row house in North Philadelphia and buying my mother a home a mile and a half away and filling up a garage with Rolls Royces and Ferraris. I mean, I don't know a whole lot of people that do that.
Right.
So I guess it is kind of people that live what you call quote-unquote normal life to even begin to understand that a I guess, you know, normally you work through a job and you work up and you get a raise, and the more you work, the older you get, the more money you make, and if you're able to get those kind of things, it's later on in life, not at 28 or so.
Teddy Pendergrass speaking to Terry Gross in 1998. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1998 interview with Teddy Pendergrass, the Philadelphia soul singer who died Wednesday at age 59. He was a romantic icon in 1982 when he had his car accident that left him a quadriplegic. Terry asked him about the accident.
It took me years to be able to drive by the accident site, so that was the point that changed my life. That's where the old Teddy died and the new guy was born. So I don't live it. I don't discuss it. I just kind of move on.
I know after the accident you went through a very deep period of depression, and you write in your book about an experience you had with a family therapist named Dr. Dan Gottlieb, who everyone at the radio station where I work, WHYY, knows because he does a show here about families. And he also was in a car accident and is also
same level quadriplegia.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And you said it was really useful to talk with a therapist who really understood what you were going through.
Mm-hmm.
He suggested during one of your bad depressions that you kind of stage a mock funeral.
Mm-hmm.
What did he suggest that you do? I mean, you actually did it. What was that experience?
It was the turning point for me. When you have gone through something as traumatic as I have, and other people have like me, you have a lot of concerns about what are you going to do with your life and where's it going to go from here. Unfortunately, my drop was in front of the world. It wasn't a guy, Joe Blow, that had a car accident. This was Teddy Pendergrass, quote unquote, had a car accident. What's going to happen? Where is he going? It was these big questions, and I played into those questions because I was concerned about those same issues. So when people started writing those things in newspapers, like I say in my book, there's a certain reporter that really asked the question, who will be the next Teddy Pendergrass? And he named out all of these potential artists, and I read that, and I went, oh, my God. You know, that really, really does hurt. So the mock funeral was a turning point for me by covering myself up or being covered up with a white sheet and having friends and family come and give me their final words as though I was dead in a casket was what that's about. Because Dr. Gottlieb felt that there was nothing really he could say. I was in such a deep depression.
So what impact did it have on you when you were sitting there under the white sheet listening to everybody speaking about your life?
I wasn't ready for that. I was not ready to be in a funeral, in a casket. Suddenly became a non-option. Killing myself was a no-no.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but from your memoir, I get the sense that after your accident, when you had to kind of recreate your life, that you had to kind of figure out what parts of you were like a performing persona and what parts of you were who you really were. Am I misinterpreting?
Yeah, I kind of had to put everything into the right perspective. Yeah.
So, Do you feel that you think of your think of yourself any differently now than you did before the accident, in terms of like the essence of who you are?
I think that the content of my character is much different than it was. I think now that I'm much more of a whole individual than I was 16 years ago. I see now that I have the audacity to move through this and make something of myself irrespective. You know what I'm saying, trying mm-hmm. to say? Rather, I'm not gonna let this keep me from being the person I know I can be and that I have proven to myself that I can be. With that, it really does make me feel that life is still enjoyable.
Teddy Pendergrass, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much, Terry.
Teddy Pendergrass speaking to Terry Gross in 1998, 12 years after the accident that left him a quadriplegic. The Philadelphia soul singer died Wednesday at age 59. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Come on and go with me. Come on over to my place. I don't feel like being lonely tonight. You see, I want some company. Just my type. You're the kind whose spirits are running free.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals, from doctors and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. From the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. And from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy. This is NPR.
The war film The Hurt Locker, about an army bomb squad in Iraq, is now out on DVD, and it's been nominated for 3 Golden Globes, Best Motion Picture, Best Director, and Best Screenplay. We hear from screenwriter Mark Boal and director Catherine Bigelow. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Fish Tank, the new film set in working-class London by director Andrea Arnold.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. What's the most dangerous army job in Iraq? Maybe it's defusing IEDs, car bombs, and other insidiously hidden explosives, knowing that your 90-pound Kevlar bodysuit with protective ceramic panels will offer only limited protection if the bomb explodes. The film The Hurt Locker, which just came out on DVD, is about an army bomb squad in Iraq made up of 3 men, one who disarms the bombs, and 2 sharpshooters who protect him while he works. The film made many end-of-year top 10 lists, and Stephen King, in Entertainment Weekly, called it the best movie of 2009. Today's next guests are the movie's screenwriter, Mark Boal, and its director, Catherine Bigelow.
Bull based his screenplay on reporting he did in 2004, embedded with an army bomb squad in Baghdad. The movie In the Valley of Ella was based on one of his articles. Catherine Bigelow's other films include Strange Days, Near Dark, Point Break, and Blue Steel. The Hurt Locker is about the work of the bomb squad, but it's also about what leads men to choose this work and what the work does to them. Jeremy Renner stars as the sergeant who's just taken over the team. He is fearless and brilliant at defusing bombs, but often recklessly risks his life and the lives of his men. In this scene, Renner and one of his sharpshooters, played by Anthony Mackie, are in Renner's room. Mackie pulls out a box from under Renner's bed, and it's filled with fuses, wires, and other remnants of bombs Renner has defused.
What do we have here?
They're, bomb parts, signatures.
Yeah, I see that, but what are they doing under your bed?
Well. This one. This one. From the UN building. Flaming car. Dead man switch. Boom. This guy was good. I like him. This one, y'all, is from our first call together. This box is full of stuff that almost killed me.
What about this one? Where's this one from, Will?
It's my wedding ring. Like I said, stuff that almost killed me.
Catherine Bigelow, Mark Bull, welcome to Fresh Air. In The Hurt Locker, we see bombs placed in all kinds of improbable places, including in a human body, in a corpse. And Mark, I'm wondering, what are some of the bomb situations you witnessed or were told about by the men you embedded with?
Well, I remember being in Iraq for probably less than 24 hours, and somebody explaining to me quite casually that he could have very easily put a bomb under the chair I was sitting on as we were having that conversation, and I would never know it. And just the realization that you can make a bomb that's small enough that, you know, it's no bigger than a bottle of water, really, and pretty much anywhere you could put a bottle of water, you could put a lethal device. And the insurgents in Iraq have been very clever and ingenious about finding places to put IEDs. And the whole sort of name of the game of the war over there is the American military is looking for the IEDs. It's almost like a giant treasure hunt, sort of the wrong word, but it's a giant game of hide and seek. And the insurgency or the resisting force, whatever you want to call it, is trying their hardest to find hiding places. So they end up putting them everywhere, is the short answer to your question. Anywhere you can imagine one being, they've tried.
Anywhere you can imagine, but what were some of the more unimaginable places?
Well, telephone poles, for example, was a sort of strange one. They started out very simply putting them in roads, in dirt roads, because it's easy to dig up a dirt road, put a bomb in it, cover up the dirt, and walk away. And as a result of that, the Americans got very careful about the dirt roads they would drive on, and they would select their routes to stay on hardtop tar roads, blacktop roads. And then so the insurgency switched and developed a method of ripping up the blacktop, putting a bomb underneath and putting fresh blacktop over, and then aging the blacktop so it was indistinguishable from the rest of the road. So then the Americans developed techniques to trigger the bomb before it hit the blacktop, and then the insurgents started putting them farther off the road into, in some cases, telephone poles, in some cases, garbage cans, in vehicles of every kind, in donkey carts. It really is one of those things where the threat is so ubiquitous that it's impossible to say with any certainty where it's coming from, and that's part of what makes the experience in Iraq so anxiety-producing for people that are over there.
Catherine, the first IED that we see go off it's close to the beginning of the film. And it's a really horrifying moment. I mean, you basically see, and I think you shot this part of this in slow motion, you basically see the pavement lift up and fragment and fly into the air. And then everything else just kind of explode around it into this, you know, ball of debris. Can you talk a little bit about shooting that scene and making it have real impact? And by that I mean, it's not special effects impact. There's so many movies where things are always blowing up and it's visually dazzling, but you don't necessarily feel anything. You're just thinking like, wow, pretty cool, stuff blowing up, big special effects. But this, you really feel the threat and the impact and the danger and the horror.
Well, I wanted to really put the viewer at the epicenter of the event and, you know, really feel that horror. And we shot the movie in the Middle East. We shot it in Amman, Jordan. That particular location happened to have been in a very densely populated area. In fact, it was near a customs house, and there was something like 200,000 cars that traveled through that area on a daily basis, although we did shut that part of the city down temporarily. But it was a very densely populated area, and we knew that had to be a form and type of detonation that was very palpable. When Mark spoke to the EOD techs in Baghdad, they spoke a lot about the fact that sometimes Hollywood movies, or in fact, virtually in every case, the explosions in a Hollywood movie doesn't necessarily look like the real thing. A lot of it has to do with what the matter is that's being detonated. But we were very interested in trying to replicate it as realistically as possible. It's in the case of a 155, which was the particular ordnance in the middle of the road, it was meant to have a very dark, dense, thick look that was very different than those kind of gaseous orange plumes of kind of fuel that perhaps maybe is more conventional in films. Anyway, so we performed this detonation, and the effects man, Richard Stutzman, did an extraordinary job, but it was a very, very large, I think you could see it for, it was like a four-story high explosion that you could see for the, you know, miles and miles. And I used something called a phantom camera, which shoots 10,000 frames per second, you know, to kind of look at the granular nature of a detonation of that size.
Since you were setting off explosions that you could see four stories high, for anyone in the area in Jordan who was hearing or seeing the blasts, how would they know that there wasn't like war breaking out down the street? How would they know for sure that this was a movie? How did you get the word out?
Well, there's actually a fairly evolved filmic infrastructure in Amman, Jordan. There's a film school as well, and many people in the area were actually aware that we were filming. We actually had been filming in the area for several days prior to the explosion. We were able to communicate with all of the individuals, all of the owners of shops, and get the word out that this explosion was coming. So it was not something that was of any kind of surprise.
Mark, when you were embedded with a bomb squad in Iraq, how close did you get to any of the explosions?
Well, I got, you know, when you're embedded, unfortunately or fortunately, you're just sort of right there with the soldiers. So I was as close as the soldiers would be. And, it depended. If they were a mile away, I was a mile away. If they were 100 yards away, I was 100 yards away. And close enough that you can feel the heat of the explosion, which is really quite impressive and intensive. It's almost like someone's taking a hairdryer and spraying it in your face. And obviously close enough that the shrapnel is whizzing by around you, and you know, it's very loud and percussive. It's like being in a rock concert.
And does the bomb squad team have a pretty decent idea of what the range of the blast will be if the blast goes off, so that they know what the safety zone is?
They do. They're kind of, they have a very keen sense of that, actually, and their whole expertise in terms of the physics of it is quite extraordinary and impressive. I mean, these are guys that are actually trained to defuse nuclear bombs. So for them to calculate the physical blast radius of an IED is something they can do. It's the kind of math they can do in their head very quickly. And so they can tell you with a pretty high degree of certainty where the blast is gonna go and what the impact will be on a given structure, whether it'll take down a house or put a hole in a house or whatever. But again, that's assuming that they know exactly what the content of the bomb is, and some of the time they don't really know.
Screenwriter Mark Boal and director Catherine Bigelow of The Hurt Locker speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let's get back to Terry's 2009 interview with Catherine Bigelow, the director of the new film The Hurt Locker, and Mark Boal, its screenwriter.
Part of the drama in The Hurt Locker comes from those moments when the person from the bomb squad, whose job it is to defuse the bomb, puts on the suit and does the walk alone to the bomb. And it seems like it would be one of the most lonely moments imaginable, because you're cut off from the world by virtue of wearing this 90-pound suit, protective suit. And then also, it's just like you there, basically right next to the bomb, trying to defuse it. Mark, would you talk a little bit about the reality of that situation, like what you witnessed when it was time for one of the men to take that walk alone?
It's an everyday occurrence, so I don't want to over-dramatize it, but there is something extremely iconic about that, and the bomb techs always talk about that walk, and it's really a mark of honor if you've done it, and it's really hard to quantify or explain if you haven't. But basically, once you put on that suit and you start walking towards the bomb, you're in a world at a certain point in which there is no turning back. And if the bomb goes off, you're dead. If you turn around and run and the bomb goes off, you're dead. So the only option is to really go right into the teeth of the matter and defuse it. And they talk about how profoundly transfixing that moment can be, and how at a certain point, say it's 50 meters out, you tend to have thoughts about your family or your friends or whatever, and then at 25 meters out, maybe your thought process changes and your heart is now beating so fast that it's really just a kind of instinctual adrenaline moment, and all the way to the moment when you're actually standing over the bomb, and it's really literally impossible to think about anything other than the simple mechanics of defusing the bomb.
Since some of the IEDs could be detonated remotely by, for instance, a cell phone, for the sharpshooters, if they saw anybody with a cell phone, at least like in the movie, they wouldn't know whether that cell phone was a detonator or just a phone. And so you're confronted with the decision, shoot or not. Is that something that the men you embedded with talked to you about or that you witnessed?
Yeah, and you know, what was just so hair-raising about the whole thing is that all these little kind of moments of everyday life that we never think about as being particularly threatening or not take on this whole new aspect when you're in a war zone, and somebody taking out a cell phone and looking at you as he's talking on the phone, you wonder if he's, you know, is he calling his wife and saying, "I'll take the roast beef for dinner tonight, honey," or is he calling his friend who is an insurgent and saying, "Hey, if you come across town, you can get a easy pot shot on a bunch of Americans right now." And it's just really, it's the combination of the lethality of the IEDs and the unknowability for somebody that doesn't speak Arabic or that isn't really versed in the culture of the motives of the people around you that makes it so hair-raising. And in particular, the thing that they would talk about is the cell phones and also people signaling with flags and kites and that kind of thing. And there was a whole sort of semiotics to that of trying to figure out whether somebody putting a carpet on their doorstep was that because they were trying to clean their carpet, or was that because they were trying to signal the neighbor across the street that there were Americans coming?
Let's talk a little bit about the casting. I mean, I think everybody who sees the film feels this way. One of the things that really throws you is that there are several pretty famous actors in the movie, including Ralph Fiennes and Guy Pearce. And, you know, you see them and you think, at first you think, oh, they're going to be the hero of the film. But, I mean, they're not necessarily, they don't even necessarily survive. And the people who are the real leads in the film, you've probably never seen before or seen only in small roles. And you think, that's a familiar face. Where did I see them? It's like reverse casting with the lesser known people in the big roles and the well-known people in the small roles. Why did you do that?
Well, part of it was to intensify and increase the element of suspense and tension, and that you're looking at a face, you're looking at an individual for whom you have kind of an awareness of, but not necessarily a specific, you know, he or she, or he in this case, doesn't come with a kind of provenance that therefore will protect him. In other words, this is a major movie star. He can't, nothing can happen to him. His life won't be in peril till the end of the film. But if you take that out of the equation, then you're looking at these particular faces and looking at these characters, and anything is possible. And so I think it sort of amplifies the tension.
Catherine, one of the things that made an impression on me in the movie is that occasionally there'd be like a stray feral cat walking across the street or down the street. And like one of the cats has only three functioning legs. And one of the cats just looks half like starved to death and kind of afraid. And I was wondering like whether you cast these cats or whether these were like stray cats that you found or that were actually happened to be walking down the street.
In all honesty, they happened to be walking down the street. Kind of the bonus of shooting in situ in a environment. It was in an area that was sort of downmarket, as shall we say. And so it's a matter of always keeping your camera department alive and looking in all directions just in case there might be some surprise. A beautiful woman up on a balcony, head shrouded in cloth, looking down, gazing down on you, and just trying to be very sensitive to the environment in which you're in and open and spontaneous and take that into consideration where you're shooting.
Director Catherine Bigelow and screenplay writer Mark Boal of The Hurt Locker speaking to Terry Gross last year. The movie just came out on DVD. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein on Fish Tank, and I'll look at one of the newest, nastiest on-air battles in the TV talk show wars. This is Fresh Air. Andrea Arnold's second feature, Fish Tank, won the jury prize at the 2009 Cannes Film Festival. It's a coming-of-age story of a complicated teenage girl from a high-rise London housing project. It opens today in New York and is available on demand from IFC Films. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
From the start, I knew the British director Andrea Arnold had captured something volatile and splendid in her second feature, Fish Tank. A girl named Katie Jarvis plays London East End 15-year-old Mia, who in the first shots stares out the window of a high-rise working-class project from a vacant flat where she practices hip-hop with tiny speakers. Mia has been phoning her best friend after a bad fight, and she heads out angrily and finds and confronts the girl in a yard, practicing hip-hop with other girls. And one calls her skanky, and Mia instantly, like lightning, headbutts her and breaks her nose. As she stomps away, you can feel her insides churn, and Arnold's handheld camera is both on her and with her. Rage, shame, defiance, longing. There's emotion in the camera's every jitter and swerve. Jarvis is in nearly every shot of Fish Tank. She has soft eyes, but her Mia is angry and defensive and has a dirty mouth. She has a feral quality that keeps you watching her closely for fear of missing something. Mia's dancing helps to channel her feelings, but despite big dreams, she's no Billy Elliot, and her accent and snaggly English teeth remind you where she comes from. It's her energy, her attack, that convinces you she won't go down without a fight. In interviews, Arnold said she wanted to cast a non-actress, and Jarvis was discovered on a train platform having a fight with her boyfriend and didn't believe the casting agent who approached her was for real. Arnold's acclaimed first feature, Red Road, centered on another outsider, a woman who monitored security cameras and spied and then spied on a man from her past. The film was formally brilliant, nearly wordless in its first half, but it didn't have the abrasive power of Fish Tank. Mia is constantly under siege by her mean and narcissistic mother, played by Kirsten Waring, and even by her nasty kid sister. So when she meets her mom's very handsome new boyfriend, Connor, his attentiveness throws her. Connor is played by the terrific chameleon Irish actor Michael Fassbender, who shows up at breakfast without his shirt while Mia is watching and imitating a hip-hop video.
Don't mind me, girl. Carry on. I was enjoying it.
As if.
You making eggs?
No.
It's the water for this.
I'm making tea.
Okay. I'm a friend of your mother's. You dance like a black. It's a compliment.
And what would you know?
I watch videos, like everyone else.
And that makes you some kind of expert, does it?
You've got a mouth, haven't you?
That scene and others between Mia and Connor will conjure up so many different emotions in different viewers that a chart of one's responses would zigzag more than an electrocardiogram. The erotic charge is strong, and so is our sense that Connor has more in common with Mia than he does with her mother, who's older than he is and often drunk. So too is the sense that a relationship between Mia and Connor would be wrong and perilous. In its outline, if not its milieu, Fish Tank bears a resemblance to the English art house hit In Education, but it has what that overrated film doesn't, something fevered and amorphous that suggests its characters are unsure of their own motives and that they're swimming, as the title implies, in a world with few options. Near the end, Mia's overcome with rage and on impulse does something shocking, nearly unforgivable. The sequence goes right to the verge of tragedy, but the final scenes have a transcendent mixture of hope and sadness that lifts kitchen sink realism to the realm of dramatic poetry. In Fish Tank, nothing for Mia goes right, yet her fate never seems preordained. Her constant motion, whether dancing, hurling obscenities, or recklessly charging ahead, might be her salvation or her doom, but you don't know, even in the last frame. That's a sign of this movie's open and deeply humanist vision.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. I'm a TV critic, and I've been astounded by the latest round of the late-night TV talk show wars. And no matter what happens today, tonight, or next week, there's no question that already the gloves are off in a way they've never been before, at least not in public. Tuesday on ABC's Jimmy Kimmel Live, that show's host sided with Conan O'Brien by doing his entire show impersonating Jay Leno. And last night on NBC's Jay Leno show, Leno had Kimmel on during his 10 at 10 segment, throwing 10 questions at Kimmel, who was seen on a giant TV screen in a satellite interview connecting Burbank with Hollywood. Leno's second question threw down the gauntlet.
All right, question two. Besides doing a cruel impression of me, what is the worst idea your writers have ever pitched you?
Well, that was my idea, to be honest, but pitch a lot of bad ideas.
That set the tone, and the tone was vicious in both directions. When Leno asked Kimmel who in the world he would most like to interview, this was Kimmel's response.
You and Conan together.
Oh, awesome.
I would like to have the two of you. I'd like just you. In fact, I'd like to do 12 at 12 with you tomorrow night,
really?
If you would be willing to do that, because I have a lot of questions to ask you about this whole thing. I don't think people care about what I have to say.
I agree with that.
What's going on in your life.
Tomorrow night, tomorrow night's bad for me. All right, let's move on.
From that point on, both Leno and Kimmel knew that Leno was boxed in, forced to ask the rest of his prepared questions. And Kimmel just swung at them like softballs, and swung for the fences. best prank Kimmel ever pulled?
Number five, you're known for pranks. What's the best prank you ever pulled?
Well, when my Aunt Chippy was at work, I painted her house orange and green once, and she was not happy.
Really?
The whole outside of the house was orange. Yeah. But I think the best prank I ever pulled was I told a guy that 5 years from now, I'm going to give you my show. And then when the 5 years came, I gave it to him, and then I took it back almost instantly.
Wow.
It was hilarious.
Wow, that's fine.
He still speaks to me.
Very good prank. Very good prank.
I think he works at Fox or something now.
Yeah, I got you. All right, number six. Ever order anything off the TV?
Like NBC ordered your show off the TV?
No. Actually, something like that, yeah.
Leno took a real risk, though, when asking question number nine.
Number nine, is there anything you haven't hosted that you want to host?
Oh, this is a trick, right?
Where
you get me to host the Tonight Show and then take it back from
me? No.
I'm not gonna listen. Listen, Lucy, I'm not Charlie Brown. I don't fall for that trick.
And even when the 10 questions were up, Kimmel squeezed off one final shot, and it was a bullseye. Oh,
really?
Listen, Jay, Conan and I have children.
Oh, I'm sorry.
All you have to take care of is cars.
That's right.
I mean, we have lives to lead here. You've got $800 million. For God's sakes, leave our shows alone.
A plea from Jimmy Kimmel. Jimmy, thank you very much, my friend. See you tonight. Jimmy Kimmel Live.
Yikes. No wonder the country is fascinated by this very public battle. It's got everybody talking. It's got the participants rolling out their A material. And it's even got me watching the Jay Leno show and laughing. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Herzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals, from doctors and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. From the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. And from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of Satchel Paige, one of baseball's greatest pitchers. We talk with his biographer, Larry Tye.
His arm was so long that it looked like it was in the pitcher's face by the time he released the ball, and he had a kind of catapult release that sent the ball in at speeds that people said had to be at least 100 to 105 miles an hour.
Join us.